Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dave Zielinski, and he'll be answering your questions on cicada madness. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as AskAboutFlyFishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Dave Zielinski about cicada madness. The Colorado River at Lee's Ferry is called by some the world's largest spring creek. It's a massive clear-running tailwater fishery that runs 15.5 miles from the base of the Glen Canyon Dam to the upper reaches of the Grand Canyon. At times, it gives the impression of being not one or two, but a series of parallel spring creek-like waterways. The fishing is great, and the scenery is gorgeous. Lee's Ferry Anglers provides professional guide service to this outstanding rainbow trout fishery, as well as food and lodging at Cliff Dwellers Restaurant and Lodge. See for yourself why Lee's Ferry is on every fly fisher's must-do list. Visit leesferryanglers.com or call them at 800-962-9755. That's leesferryanglers.com or call them at 800-962-9755. Before we introduce Dave, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Dave's section that says register for the free drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Dave's book, Cicada Madness, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, take good notes, and maybe you'll win Dave's book, Cicada Madness. Our guest tonight is Dave Zielinski. For the last 20 years, Dave has been tracking down periodical cicada emergences to figure out their mystery and the fish that hunt and devour them. Dave's book, Cicada Madness, Timing, Fishing Techniques, and Patterns for Cracking the Code of Epic Cicada Emergencies, is the culmination of his experiences and is currently the only dedicated resource for fly fishing cicadas. Dave resides in rural western Pennsylvania with his wife, three daughters, and two German short-haired pointers, where he spends his spring and summer chasing fish and chasing birds over dogs in the fall. He is also the owner and operator of Down Home Boat Works, where he designs and builds custom wooden drift boats for fly fishing and river running. Dave, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hi, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you. Let me just check my volume here. Okay. All right. Yeah, so lots of questions, Dave. Sorry, folks, if you're on still, great, because we had some technical difficulties getting the player on our homepage, and but we're here now, and so the few of you that remain will get to benefit from that. And, of course, we'll have the recording, too, so you didn't miss anything. Okay, so, Dave, just recently, when did Cicada Madness come out? Was it the last fall?
Cicada Madness came out on October of
2023, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so tell us, you know, give us a brief overview of the book and tell us what inspired you to write it.
Yeah, so the book is, as you said, all about cicadas. Chasing Cicada Hatches, Wherever They May Occur. And it covers both periodical emergences and annual emergences, which we can get into in a little bit here. Fishing techniques, lots of fly patterns. There's 59 different fly patterns included in the book, as well as a few tutorials. And then lots of information about locations and where the bugs occur and how to find them. So to answer the second half of that question, is what inspired me to write that book is, just like the intro had said, chasing these things for the past few decades. Very intriguing bug, and learning a lot about it, and really encountering lots of fishermen who haven't encountered it or only caught it by chance, and lots of misinformation or just lots of unknown about this bug and how it relates to epic fishing.
Yeah, it's like one of those things you hear about, but you've never experienced. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of like a salmon fly hatch, too, you know? I mean, if you're there that day, then you're a lucky fly fisher, right? And at least that's been my experience. So, but I do, and I'll ask you about this later, but I do hear them outside my window here in Boulder, Colorado, at night in the summertime. So I'm assuming those are annuals, but I haven't seen them on the river. Anyway, we'll get to that in a little bit. Can you kind of explain what makes, you know, the cicada emergences so significant for fly fishers, for those of us that haven't experienced it?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the east, and about like middle United States towards the east, there's very significant periodical is these cicadas emerge on a 13-year or a 17-year. This is this massive synchronized emergence where all of those bugs will emerge in that year. So what happens is such an influx to the ecosystem of biomass that everything eats them. And if you're near water, fish are going to eat them too. So what makes it so special is that it's rare, and that when it happens, it is, you use all the different adjectives you can find, epic, apocalyptic, you know, things like that come to mind, where there's a million bugs per acre in
place. Wow.
Happen. Yeah,
that's hard to even imagine, you know, and they're not small either, right? I mean,
the periodical cicadas are about an inch and a half to almost 2 inches long.
That's a meal Yeah, for anything, right? Birds, fish, whatever, probably even raccoons are scooping them up. So kind of describe, you know, what the cicada looks like, if you could.
Sure. So cicada is a true bug. There are 3,000 species worldwide. I know I just introduced kind of the periodical cicadas, but there are annual cicadas that occur across the world. In all parts of the U.S., every state has cicadas. Parts of Canada have cicadas that are the annual variety. More or less every year, bugs happen. And some years there's a lot of bugs, and some years so many. But they occur every year. They all are the same shape. A cicada is a kind of a stout, thick body. It has two sets of wings. It's from the order Hemiptera, half wing. So there's two outer wings, and then there's two smaller, shorter inner wings. There are six legs, so three pairs of legs, and cicadas have big bulging eyes. Periodical cicadas all have big red, and most annual cicadas have darker color. Colorations vary from lots of black and orange to white on their bellies to gold or bronze, with green and blues, and then even camouflage.
So we'll get to talking about patterns later, because I'll be interested to know, does it make any difference when fish are on the feed of these, but we'll talk about patterns later. So are you saying that the periodicals are only on the eastern side of the U.S. and everywhere else are annuals?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So periodical cicadas are just such a strange mystery and only occur from about middle of the United States, middle half the country, towards the east, and very prevalent across the southern states and into the mid-Atlantic. That Midwest area, Illinois, Missouri, all have cicadas all the way down.
Yeah, you have a map showing that. And that's why I was curious about, you know, in your book, that map of, you know, all the east. And I was going, well, why isn't the west in there? But I didn't understand at that point the difference between, you know, the periodicals and the annuals. So that makes more sense now. So tell us what, you know, granted, some life cycle is, what, a year? And others are 13 or 17 years, right? Kind of explain what their life cycle is?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing about the periodicals, there's also annuals where periodicals occur as well.
Oh,
annuals,
okay.
Cicadas everywhere, but only periodicals. That's right. Into the life cycle, all cicadas have the same life cycle, just some are long, short. And there's lots of scientific reasons of explanations why the way some of these bugs have evolved. Predation cycles. It's actually related to climate. It's related to potentially the formation of the Great Lakes and how glaciers retreated, and also climatic events like fire or storms or things like that are all possible theories on why periodic cicadas have a long life cycle. But all of those cicadas' life cycles start the same. So it starts with an egg. And that egg is in the ground. I'll come full circle explanation. Start with that egg. It is actually an egg in a that is deposited by its mother in a twig. And that egg and about 500 other eggs from that single mother cicada are deposited into the young bark of the new growth adult mature tree. So she uses a device and a piece of anatomy on her abdomen, and she will cut into the bark and deposit. Those eggs will quickly turn into a larva and fall to the ground, and those larvae will crawl into the ground where they spend most of their life, whether they're an annual cicada or.
Dave, hold on a second. You're kind of cutting out. I think it's your noise canceling mic. Can you switch to just the regular phone?
Sure.
Because it's you're like fading out, and then I'm not sure I'm hearing something, and it comes back again. So
let's see here.
How's that?
Yeah, much better. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what you caught there or didn't. The cicada larva goes into the ground. And depending on its life cycle, it evolves underground into various stages of its nymphal form. Like a lot of insects, it will molt because it grows and it needs to grow into the next size. So it sheds its exoskeleton and it molts and it grows a new one. And it does this 3, 4, 5 times throughout its underground life cycle. Now, annual cicadas, periodical cicadas do the same thing. They will feed on the tree roots of where which it lives underground. And they do this through their anatomy on their face, which is the proboscis, which is a long straw-type mechanism that has the ability to pierce into tree roots or vegetation and be able to suck out the sap or the xylem that feeds it. And that's the only thing they eat. So for their life cycle as a nymph underground, they will just travel around the tree root system and continually feed and molt and feed and molt until they are nearing their phase of adulthood. What's interesting with cicadas is there's all kinds of different triggers for emergence, depending on if it's an annual or a periodical cicada. So for a periodical scale, it takes either 13 years or 17 years to reach that adult stage. So if we take, for instance, the 17-year cicada, in the spring of its 17th year from birth, it's now the year that it's supposed to emerge, it will start to travel up towards the surface of the earth in the springtime. When the soil temperature is about 64 degrees at the depth of about 8 inches, will signal that trigger to emerge from the ground and begin its adult phase of life. This will happen. So if you are where I live, for instance, in Pennsylvania, that temperature depends on how much sunlight will hit the ground and how it progresses as we reach summertime. So summer solstice is about June 20th. If I back that up where I live, the periodical cicadas will emerge somewhere in that last week of May. That's when the ground soil temperature is up and triggers that emergence. If you live in the south, if you live in southern states, say below West Virginia, into Tennessee, North Carolina, and then on further down into Georgia, it's going to happen weeks earlier. So You're going to have an earlier, spring happens earlier in the south than it does for me in Pennsylvania. So you pay attention to the trigger of when the ground temperature is 64 degrees at about 8 inches, that's when a periodical cicada gets that trigger to emerge. For annual cicadas, it's not a mass emergence. So bugs will happen, on and off for several weeks across the summer. And it's really understudied and rarely unknown on some species of annual cicadas on why they emerge when they do. Some studies show that it's amount of rainfall, which sort of makes sense, and theories support that. They feed on plants, and plants suck up water, and cicadas eat it through the root system. There are some kind of triggers that say, okay, we've reached enough waterfall or rainfall, and it's time to emerge. No matter the cicada, they come out of the ground. They spend most of their life underground, only spend the last phase of their life, which is only a few weeks, as adults. So once that cicada emerges, it finds the first vertical surface that it can. It's usually the tree trunk or another tree trunk or a street sign, a telephone pole, anything that's vertical. And it'll begin to crawl up that. And this usually happens under the cover of darkness because of predation. They're very vulnerable at this time. So they will climb up a tree and then begin the process of morphing into their final form, which is the winged adult. So much like you mentioned a stonefly hatch, much like a stonefly crawls out on a rock, crawls out on streamside vegetation, and then it begins to extract itself from its nymphal shuck, the cicada does the exact same thing. So it does that, and then the temperature and humidity and time allow that cicada to harden, fill its wing veins, and change into its final color and form over the next several hours. With periodical cicadas, you get a mass emergence. So what you will see is over the course of a couple of days, you'll see a few bugs and then a few bugs more, and then all of a sudden there are thousands of bugs all doing this. If you happen to get lucky enough to go out at night with a flashlight and go scope around trees, you'll find this process happening and taking place. And there's several photographs in my book of this. Once morning comes, most of those cicadas are in their final adult form, and they're just kind of hanging out. And the reason is temperature affects their mobility as well as it affects some other things about them. So in the mornings are cool. The cicada needs about 68 degrees to be able to move around and fly and do its thing. So early mornings, you're going to find a lot of cicadas that are tucked up under leaves, on the bark of trees, just kind of hanging out and waiting. Also very vulnerable at this time, and animals learn very quickly You mentioned raccoons. That's absolutely the case. Skunks, possums, raccoons, turtles, snakes, everything. Once they realize that they're around, they will start to eat them. So once
anything
it's
the anything that's an omnivore is going to be eating them, I think.
You're right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. We've seen deer eat them. I mean, we've seen things that are actually herbivores eat them, including grass carp, which are primarily vegetarian as well. Everything will turn to this food source when it's available.
Mm-hmm.
So once the day progresses, your best cicada days are your hottest days because of that temperature effect. They're the most active, most mobile, most vocal when it's hot out. So the day progresses and it's warm enough. Let's say it gets into the 70s and then the 80s and even the 90s. So if you can imagine where these are going to occur, where they occur across the Midwest and South, it's not uncommon to have 90-degree temperatures in late May and early June at times. It's the hottest time. It's when cicadas will be the most active. So what happens is their last phase of life is to do one thing, and that is to mate, procreate, and lay the next set of eggs for the next generation. So once it's warm enough, they're able to fly, but the males are also then able to sing. And the cicadas, the males of the species of all cicadas, are the only ones that possess the ability to make a call.
Mm-hmm.
The males have a piece of anatomy on their abdomens called the timbals, which is a set of muscles that they flex rapidly. Their abdomens are largely hollow, which acts like an amplifier, and they will make this sound of cicadas. Various species make a certain specific frequency of sound to attract the female of that species. That female responds to that frequency of the call. So what happens is the male cicadas will start to sing to attract female mate. But what they also do is they attract the males over there. So what you end up happening is large congregations of cicadas, both male and female, in an area. And this area might be an acre. It might be a grove of trees. It might be an entire hillside. And if you're lucky, that hillside's going to be next to a river or a lake.
Mm-hmm.
So the female cicadas hear that, they respond to it, fly to it. When a female cicada finds a suitable mate, she flicks her wings, and it signals the male cicada that we're going to mate. They do their thing, and then she immediately goes on to deposit her eggs in that new branch, young of the year branch, leafy branch of that tree. Those eggs hatch, and the larva fall to the ground, and the whole process repeats. And sometimes it takes a year, 2 years, 4 years for annual species, and then for periodicals, it's going to be 13 years till you see them again, or 17 years.
Now, so they spend 13 or 17 years under the ground eating roots,
yeah.
Basically. Wow.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, that's pretty.
A lot of roots.
That's amazing for an insect. Most insects. Well, you know, like stoneflies stay alive quite a long period of time. I forget what it is.
Yeah.
But so many of them, you know, mate, die, lay eggs, you know, all in a day. Yeah.
Yeah, the cicadas around for a few weeks. It happens. So the cicadas they're going to be typically around for a month, periodical cicadas, for a month doing their thing. So there's lots of opportunity there for everybody,
yeah.
For predators,
yeah.
For fish, for fishermen.
What about for the annuals? I mean, what's mm-hmm. their longevity like? Are they weeks as well, or all summer, or how does that work?
Yes. So what's interesting about the species and how they've evolved, periodical cicadas, they do this mass emergence, and there's a million bugs an acre. It's been studied. There's been counts. A million bugs per acre. So if you imagine an entire hillside of a 500-acre forest, how many bugs that is. The reason that is for predator satiation. Predators just can't get them all. It's just like our mayfly hatches. Mayflies, you know, you go to you see a fantastic spinner fall, and there's a million bugs. And cedar waxwings are eating them. fish are eating them, other things are eating them, but they just can't get them all, so it ensures the survival of the species. So the annual cicada, so the periodical cicada is kind of safety in numbers type of thing, whereas the annual cicadas, at times, there can be years of very high numbers of annual cicadas, and then there can be years of not so many. You can liken this to hopper plagues, right? Grasshopper plagues. Some years there's whatever factors line up that there's the farmers are afraid the hoppers are going to eat the crops, and you know there's great fishing on the Bighorn River or whatever because of it. But then other years, or most years, there's not that many. The annual cicada is actually evolved to avoid predation through some skills. It's a very agile flyer. It is typically well camouflaged to hide from predators. And when annual cicadas are around my property in the summertime every year, I chase them around and I, you know, sneak up on them in a tree when I hear one and I try to catch it. And it's very difficult. They're very agile. They're very aware of their surroundings, and they can get away from predation because there's not as many of them to ensure the survival of the species. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the annual species, one species will come every year. What, you know, like you said, sometimes many, sometimes few. But will the same species emerge every year?
Yeah. So with the annual species, it's just almost like any other insect. It's almost just like your grasshoppers, right?
Yeah.
So
maybe
you're going to have some this year, and you're going to have a whole lot next year, and some the other year. And it's a lot of unexplainable factors, and that's what we're – there are scientists trying to study some of these. There's actually a species that's been studied quite a bit, Okanagana magnifica. It's a big cicada that is in the – West. These actually occur on the Green River in Utah. These are the ones that the guides call the Mondos. These are the big ones. The green actually gets two cicadas, a small one and a large one. That large one, it also is in California. It's around like desert environments. That's actually a pretty well-studied cicada where they've determined that there is a threshold of rainfall that will trigger emergence, plus that cicada needs 3 years plus a threshold of rainfall, and then it'll emerge that next year. And they've predicted it, and it's reliable, and it occurs. So watching rainfall counts and knowing when the last one occurred, add 3 years, get to that right number of millimeters of rainfall, and that following year is pretty predictable that there's going to be a high number of those bugs.
So every year with the annuals, they're not actually from the same
Acorns. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And they're rotating through the years, I guess, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they overlap on each other, right? So, like I said, more or less some happen every year and find their way to mate and find their way to carry the next generation on, but it overlaps. When you have periodicals, they are separated by 13 years, 17 years. They just don't, there's not those mature bugs in the ground on a year-to-year basis to occur. What's interesting with periodicals, though, is there are multiple broods of them that are the different age classes that almost fit together like a puzzle.
Okay, hold that thought.
Yeah, I will.
Hold that thought. I have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll explore that, because that's going to be a longer conversation, I'm sure. We'll be back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, theuglybugflyshop.com or 866-845-9284. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Dave Zielinski about cicada madness. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. But Dave, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So I know finishing a book is a big accomplishment and takes a lot of time and energy, but what else are you up to?
Yeah, so we're on the verge of daylight savings time in Pennsylvania, so I'm going to get more daylight, so definitely fishing some more. We have right now, so I'm in my fishing right now, it's finishing up some of the Great Lakes steelhead stuff that's not too far from me, and then right into dry fly season with the blueing olives and then caddis hatches into sulfurs and mayflies. But, you know, what's really on my mind is planning for the upcoming periodical cicada emergences in May and June. It's going to be a great year.
Yeah, is it? Yeah, well, we'll have to talk about that more here. I mean, you also have a boat building business as well, right?
I do. I do a number of things. So in addition to that book, which came out in October 2023, I've been a long-time wooden boat builder, designer for several years now. I built my first drift boat back in 1999 or 2000, and then had since built several more, and then started to evolve the designs. And these are standard type of drift boats, river dories, skiff types, and even a motored skiff now. But I've designed these over several years and, you know, built them for my own use and then started to sell the plans. So my online boat business, www.downhomeboatworks.com, is where you can find the plans. I actually have a free set of plans on there right now to get folks started into it. And it's been a fun journey with wooden boats and seeing people build boats of their own and then designing my own kind of designs tailored for specific places, rivers that we fish here in the East.
Nice, nice. Yeah. Always appreciate those wooden boats, you know, and all the work that goes into them. They look beautiful. Yeah. Work of art for sure. Good. So again, it was downhomeboatworks.com. If anybody's interested in boat plans and so forth, that's where they can reach you through, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Good. Okay. We just mentioned broods, and that I was going to ask you about that because I guess my question is there a periodical emergence every year, but they're just rotating, and are they in different places?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Great question. And just before the break, we started to get into it. Yeah, broods. So periodical cicadas are the only ones that are the only cicadas that have named broods. And it was back in the 1890s, I believe, a scientist with the Department of Agriculture started to collect all this information that has been kind of studied for a couple hundred years already on periodical cicada observations. And they found that there was a number of regular occurrences, whether they were 13 or 17 year. And to basically categorize them, they broke them down into naming them with a convention of using Roman numerals. So what we have today, they accounted for a brood a year and then just assigned that name to whenever that brood emerged. So we have 12 broods of 17 year cicadas, and we have three broods of 13-year periodical cicadas. The second part of your question, there are some missing broods, but if you are willing to do some driving and traveling around that middle America to the east, you can almost find a periodical emergence every year. You may go 2 years without one or 1 year without one, but if you drive around, you will find, if you look at that map in my book, you will find a regular occurrence of one of those 17s or 13s. They're geographically unique in their range, so you actually have to go to them. So if it's a cicada year like this year is for a periodical, you actually have to go to it. They're not going to come to you. You have to understand where it's going to occur and be there when it happens.
Which one, where is the one happening this year?
Well, we're lucky this year because it's actually two, which is an apocalyptic event, if you will. We actually have two broods that occur, a co-emergence this year. So 2024, the last time this happened was the year 1803.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And you can now start to maybe understand why I released my book when I did. We have a brood XIX, which is a 13-year brood, and we have brood XIII, which is a 17-year brood. 17 times 13 is 221. These two broods will not meet again for another 221 years.
Now, these are actually different species, right?
Well, what's so crazy about it is they are different species of the same family. Yeah, so Magis cicada is the family, and then there's these 13-year subspecies and 17-year subspecies. So they just so happen to co-emerge this year. Now, remember what I said about the frequency thing, that the males make the call? They attract the female counterpart of their species.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was just going to ask. So they don't interbreed then.
So they're not likely to interbreed, but you can bet scientists are all over this, because think about the last time this occurred. Thomas Jefferson was president. There was no scientist studying that aspect of it, right? So they got a great opportunity this year.
Yeah. And where is this occurring? Is it in western Pennsylvania and Ohio?
No, not in Pennsylvania at all. So I'm driving. It's going to be about 17 states. Will have some of these cicadas. Now, the co-emergence thing, folks get excited about that, which certainly I am as well, because it provides a lot of opportunities across about 17 states. Now, that doesn't mean that they occur in the same areas. The actual area of overlap is a very, very small area around Springfield, Illinois. So there's 13 the east and south, and there's 17 kind of north and west, and they actually are very close, but they actually may not actually overlap on top of one another. So scientists are all over that and studying that. The key here is that you have two broods to chase. The 13-year cicada is called the Great Southern Brood, which is very prevalent across the South. Georgia, North Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, parts of Virginia, a little spot near the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, and then across down to Arkansas. And that 17-year brood is going to be very heavy around Illinois, parts of Indiana, the very bottom of Lake Michigan, Missouri. So those areas there are going to have 17. So lots of opportunities. Whether you live in the west or you live in the east or you live in the south, I'm looking at, an 8-hour drive to hit some cicadas somewhere. And most people are in those areas are probably looking at a little bit less. So,
I see that in your map where you've got it color coded. Yeah. The brood XIX, the 13 years, the light purple or bluish color there. Yeah. And then the dark brown is the...
Yeah, it's like a brown. Yep.
I can see, where they... Yeah, that 13-year is covering a lot of ground, that's for sure.
It is one of the most widely distributed broods that occurs,
But very heavy in Missouri and southern Illinois. Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
You can kind of do a road trip, right? I mean, start in the south at the earliest part of the season, work your way north. And
you've got it.
Yeah. It's kind of like following the other hatches, like green drake hatches up the river.
That's actually what we're doing. What you mentioned there is what we're doing. We're driving south, and we're going to start there, and then we're going to kind of work our way up and catch it, later as it goes north. Opportunities, maybe not enough time off from work.
Yeah. I was going to say, how closely are there locals that you connect with that can, more accurately predict when the emergence will be?
Yeah, that's a big part of, So that whole scouting piece is a very big part of the book. It's really the heart of the book in there in the center. It's like, how, okay, now you know about this bug. Now how do you go find it? And when do you go? And how do you look for the signs and all that stuff? And my book goes into great detail of that. But yes, I have friends and people monitoring and, you know, providing us the intelligence, you know, on when these things started. And so there's a little bit of messing around with that, because one grasshopper doesn't make a grasshopper fishing the greatest, right? And the same goes for cicadas. So just because you see one bug doesn't mean the fish know anything about them. Mm-hmm. These are terrestrial insects that are only in the water by accident. Now, when you get the numbers that I quoted, millions of bugs per acre, if you happen to get that next to a river, imagine just 1% of those bugs making their way into the river, and they do. That turns on great fishing, but it doesn't happen the immediate when the bugs hatch. It's going to be 8 or 10 days after that emergence where these bugs are now flying around a whole bunch and doing their mating thing. And when they're flying, they're going to get knocked down. So you can be too early for a cicada emergence. And I actually said this to somebody yesterday, is I'd rather be too late than be too early.
Yeah.
Be too late, those fish still remember. They still remember those bugs, and they'll still eat them.
I remember a trip my father and my son and I took to Alaska. We were on the Togiak River, and we went for silver salmon. And that year, they were like, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks late, you know. Yep. And so we didn't get the prime run. We had a lot of fun doing other fishing. We did get some silvers, but they weren't the numbers that, you know, were normal.
Sure.
And, yeah, you can never, you know, totally predict nature, that's for sure.
That's right.
Is there any kind of an official network of notification of the hatches, you know, throughout the country, yeah, like a website or something like that? Or?
Yeah, there is a great tool available. And I talk about it a little bit in the book, and one of the scientists that I, you know, consulted with when I was writing the book, and his name is Dr. Gene Kritsky. And Dr. Kritsky is actually out of Mount St. Joseph University in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he actually developed an app back in, I want to say, 2019, in preparation for Brood X, which was a very prevalent Ohio emergence in 2021. So he developed this app, and it's called Cicada Safari. So Cicada Safari basically uses us, people with iPhones and smartphones, to download the app. And it's very simple. You find a cicada, you take a picture of it, and you upload it. And what that does is populate a map of emergence. And they promote this, and they use this for scientific research to really find the distribution of the various broods as best as they can. So it's basically like crowdsourcing data. We pay attention to this app during the emergence, and we're like, hey, we're near here, we're 50 miles away, and look, somebody just posted, you know, a photo of the cicada, and we go and, you know, find it, chase it down on the map. And, you know, the one thing I can guarantee you with periodical cicadas is if you find one, I guarantee you it's going to be millions. So that's all you need. So, yeah, that's probably the best tool that we have today. And I tell you, it's really helped our fishing on previous emergences in 2020, 2021. Going to places we've never been for. Yeah.
Yeah. CicadaSafari.org, right?
CicadaSafari.org.
Cool, yeah. Let me take a quick break here, and we'll come back and talk more here in just a few seconds. So hang tight. We'll be right back. Enrico Puglisi Flies pride themselves with creating unique and one-of-a-kind flies and fly-tying material. Enrico has been experimenting with durable synthetic and natural materials to create flies that catch fish for more than 30 years. His innovative products include brushes, fibers, and components that have made a major impact on the direction of saltwater fly fishing, and his methods and materials are respected worldwide. Whether you want your flies hand-tied for you or you'd like to tie your own, be sure to visit Enrico Puglisi Flies and browse their online catalog. Visit epflies.com and do a little shopping today. Again, that's epflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dave Zielinski about cicada madness. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just fill out that form on our homepage and send it in, and we'll try to get an answer tonight on the show. Okay. Yeah, the other question that arose is in my mind was, we talk about it being near water. Now, do cicadas need to be near water, you know, for just general living when they're underground or when they're mating or anything, or is that just coincidental that they're by the water to please us?
Yeah, you have to find them near water, so it's going to be coincidental. So usually where you have periodical cicadas, you are going to have them in large numbers over patches of woods. So the thing they need is they need trees, okay? So riverbanks, most riverbanks have lots of big mature trees. So what ends up happening is development happens and maybe along rivers, but they don't cut the trees right against the river. Cicadas will kind of navigate to those trees where they're available. But you're only finding when you look at a distribution of cicadas, they're not all near water. They're mostly just in big woods. So that's part of the scouting of this is you look at those brood distribution maps and then you say, like, well, cicadas are in this area. Well, there's also this river in this area. And what you do is you go and you scout. You got to go and look for it. Or you find this reservoir or lake that falls in that geographic distribution of where bugs should be. You go at the right time of year, that end of May in Pennsylvania, and, you know, earlier, could be late April if you're really far south. And you just go, and you go and you look. You look for the signs. You look for the bugs. You look for the nymphal shucks on trees. You look for the holes in the ground that a cicada crawled out of, and then you listen. You listen for the male cicadas making noise. But you got to go find those areas and then find the water rays that are near them, and there's a little bit of hope there that you hope cicadas are near enough that body of water where they're going to end up in the water. So, no, yeah, they don't need water in their adult life. They actually don't do much eating or drinking at all at that final stage of life.
So they just mate and die, basically, shortly thereafter.
Pretty much. Now, here's an interesting one. So annual cicadas, I mentioned the Green River earlier. One of your sponsors, Lee's Ferry. Lee's Ferry has cicadas.
Oh, do they?
These are desert environments, right? So when you look at the Grand Canyon at Lee's Ferry and Marble Canyon, and you look at the Green River below Flaming Gorge in Utah, those were desert environments which primarily had a dry riverbed. So those cicadas didn't need a river to be there. We happened to make a functional trout river where those cicadas were first. The cicadas that live on Lee's Ferry and the cicadas that live in that canyon on the Green are the same species. It's a small species called Platypedia. It's a desert variety cicada, and it's very unique, and it's actually very small. And then there's the one I mentioned earlier, the Okanagana, which is a very giant cicada. But they don't need water. Those are desert bugs that we happen to put some pretty sweet tailwaters in and have excellent fishing with cicadas on.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the thing about Western rivers is whether it's a tailwater or not, or actually more so if it's not a tailwater, but there's usually a lot of willows and cottonwoods, you know, along the rivers.
Right.
So there's your trees and your new fresh growth and stuff, I think, that they would be looking for.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, beyond that, and that makes it good for us fly fishers, I think, because those are close to the river, and as further you get away from the river, there's less large trees.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it works out well for us, it sounds like. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Very good, very good. Well, as you said before we started the show, we did get a lot of questions. Now, maybe we'll address Mobile Bay, Greg Nichols in Alabama. Are they that far south, periodicals?
Yeah, there's going to be, so I don't know about that actual location on a map, but I can tell you around Montgomery, Birmingham, Alabama, they're definitely going to have periodical cicadas there this year. It's probably going to be sometime in late April. probably can't go wrong in May.
Okay. And the other, there's several questions about Montana, Idaho. Yeah, Troy in Idaho said he saw cicadas back in 2014, but hasn't seen them since. Utah, Arizona, all these western states, people were asking about, you know, cicada emergences. But so in all those cases, we're talking about annuals, number one,
yep.
And they could be heavy or they could be light, depending on the year, right?
Yeah, the key there is, so yes, cicadas exist in all those states and then some. So all those western states have cicadas. There's a couple things there. So, and I have this in my book, some typical western cicadas and what states they inhabit in these species. You have to know a few things. You got to know what time of year those cicadas are going to emerge. And you have to know the species, obviously, to match kind of that pattern. So the time of year is going to be interesting for a lot of those because it's some of them will happen during pretty high runoff periods. So you're almost going to be like those tailwaters are going to be the best ones to target. I know places along the Front Range, places in Montana, will get some cicadas in late June and into July, which is just at the end of runoff. And then some annual cicadas as well that'll happen in July, August. If you live there, it's one thing, but if you're planning a trip there from somewhere else as a destination, you want to hit cicadas, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough. Some of the more reliable ones are like the Green River. Those are tailwaters, Lee's Ferry is tailwater. Those bugs are going to happen in May, end of May, June, fantastic fishing in the first week of June, first 2 weeks of June. Often, and then that second variety cicadas will happen a little bit later and extend into July. So you're kind of looking at tailwater. So, you know, kind of recap on that western thing is check out in that book or check out other resources for what cicadas live in, say, Idaho, and what time of year do they emerge. And I have some of that information in my book, but there's likely more online and available through. What I used to do was call universities and say, does anybody study entomology there? And what do they know about cicadas? And what cicadas live in Idaho? And when do they happen? And really start to ask those questions to the engineer, science departments. And they love talking about it. They love getting those phone calls. And then once you do that, you kind of like, you got to be there at the right time to encounter them. And then you're kind of looking for the same thing. Are you looking for holes in the ground? Looking for bugs, listening for bugs, and things like that. And then the last resort piece of it, which is probably the most effective, is just fish a cicada. You would a hopper or a big tractor, and fish will eat it. Fish will eat it.
If you start hearing cicadas, is it too late? Or are you right in the middle of it? In other words, and I'm just thinking about, you know, where we are in Boulder, Colorado, which is Front Range Rockies, you know. We got Boulder Creek just down the hill from me here. But we have the windows open sometimes in the spring and fall. And, you know, I just remember hearing the cicadas out there in the trees right outside the house here. So I never paid attention to what time of year that was, or, you know, never paid attention to going and fishing. But there's a lot of trees down by Boulder Creek running right through Boulder. So I imagine if cicadas are up here, they're probably down there as well. but like you say, you got to go scouting, right? But
yes.
If you're hearing them, is it, you know, and it's the first you've heard, should you run out there and check?
So that's the time? Remember what the hearing them means. It means mating, right? So what does then mating mean? It means attracting females, which means bugs are flying. That's exactly what you want. So, you know, regardless whether it's annuals, and I've fished, you know, some Front Range ones, and the cicadas you have there are ones that they kind of call clickers or flicker cicadas. So they make, it almost sounds like cracking matchsticks or a twig, right? So some of the cicadas are very subtle. But they make a clicking sound or a chattering sound. And what they're attracting females. So that incites flying. And what you want is flying. So when they're flying, most of our cicada best fishing, or put it this way, it's middle of winter, and I get on my phone and I look at videos from cicada time, and when I turn them on and you hear the roar of cicadas and, you know, catching fish on cicadas, it's just, there it is. That's what we live for. And so when you're hearing them, it is not too late. It's time. It's time.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And, yeah, Tim Huckabee asked about the 13 and 17. And he says he hears it's all going down in the east, but we have some in the west, so are we getting any? So hopefully we answered that, Tim, about the annual and periodicals. So we're not getting the periodicals out here west, from what Dave's explained, right? Let's talk about patterns here for a few minutes. You've got a lot of patterns in your book, and in some ways I wonder, well, how important is a pattern when these fish are on the feed and they're ravenous? Are they get to take about anything? I mean, or does it help to be pattern, you know, hatch specific, so to speak?
Yeah, yeah. So different parts of the, it's just like our mayflies and, you know, caddis hatches. Look at the patterns available for any of those things. There's 10 times the mayfly patterns than the cicada patterns that exist. But different phases of the hatch might call for different tactics and different patterns. So if you're fishing a high-pressured waterway and everybody's out fishing cicadas, you might need something that's a little bit different towards that middle to end of the hatch. When fish, in the beginning of the hatch, when the fish just realizes this is food, it's ravenous. So you're spot on. You probably don't need much other than to copy the size and really basic form factor and color. When we're talking periodical cicadas, it's black with orange. And you need a size 4 or 6 hook, black foam, orange thread, and then choose your wing of choice, whether that's EP trigger point fibers or elk hair or Z-lon, whatever you want to use. Pick your poison, but it's a lot of black foam, orange rubber legs, orange thread, and you can go from there. What I look for in cicada patterns are a few things. It starts with a good hook. I'm using a lot of Gammakatsu B10S, which is a wide gape, thin wire, but very strong hook. I'll use that for bass. I'll use that for carp. I don't typically use that for trout because it's such a wide gap and it's such a big fly that on an average trout of, say, 14 to 16 inches, it can do a lot of damage.
Yeah.
So I'll typically downsize to, like, a number 6, like just a streamer hook, a stout streamer hook, pinch the barb, has a smaller gap, but that long shank allows you to build about the same size fly on it. And you'll actually find you actually get better hookups with that smaller hook, and it's a bit nicer to the fish. You get less of the tongue hook. You get less of the, you know, kind of in-the-throat hook type stuff, and you get more, you know, in that jaw. So it starts with a hook, and then I like a pattern that is durable and that I can tie fast. And probably one of the most important factors is that I can see it. When we're fishing cicadas, you can catch them all over in the river, but I tend to find that I catch lots more bigger fish when I present the fly much further away. So long casts, which means I'll need to see that fish. So almost every cicada pattern that I'll tie, you'll see in my box, has a big indicator on the top. Mm-hmm. So I can spot that from far away.
Okay. Yeah, Gary Kaufman from Pennsylvania, he says, is there any difference in patterns between the 13 and 17-year cicada other than having 17 years to tie the 17-year cicada pattern? So we learned that's not the case either, right?
Yeah, so there's differences in, that's a great question. So between 17 and 13, they're about the same. They're the same subspecies. And they've evolved from the same species. So the form factor is the same. The colorations are the same. There are, what's interesting about these is there's multiple species that emerge at the same time. And they're, again, subspecies. But the major difference is the size. So the 17-year septendecim is a subspecies. And that's a pretty big fly that from the tip of the wings to its head is going to be about 1.5 to 1.75 inches long. The other subspecies, or one of the other subspecies, the Cassini, is about 1 to 1.25 inches, and it's jet black underneath. So it's still black and orange, but it's just a smaller variation. So what you'll typically see, like in my box, is I've got sizes 2, I've got sizes 4, I've got sizes 6, I've got sizes 8, with primarily needing number 4s and number 6s. And with that, you're covering kind of the size range of all the periodical cicadas. And, of course, with annuals, you want to match your, you know your bug and match it to size.
And when you're, like, when you take this road trip this spring, will you be looking for particular fish, you know, be it smallmouth, largemouth, trout, or will you be switching around depending on where you are? Are you picky about that?
Yeah, I think what's funny about that is, you know, you'll catch, sometimes you can go on a quest to catch, like, every species you can find, because every species in a river or a lake system will eat cicadas, so you can find some pretty crazy stuff. Like, catching catfish on dry flies is pretty crazy. We catch hundreds of carp on dry flies.
Yeah,
I mean, I have pictures of 4 of us that were all hooked up at the same time on carp, like, which is pretty crazy to happen, right?
Yeah,
carp are notoriously difficult when they're, you know, face down in the mud, but when they're up on cicadas, they're pretty darn easy. So, yeah, it'll depend on the waterway in the area. A good trout river, we'll definitely be targeting trout and sizing our patterns as such, and then, you know, going to catch a bunch of carp for a couple of days or whatever on a reservoir or a bigger river, we'll be targeting them. You'll catch a lot of bass, as maybe, like, if you're just blind fishing, like just blind casting cicadas. The fun thing with carp is you're doing all sight fishing, so you're usually 9 times out of 10 seeing a pod of carp cruising looking for bugs, and you're throwing to them just like they're bonefish, but they're eating off the surface. So the sight game's pretty good, and that's what makes it kind of fun.
Yeah. So the characteristics that you kind of look for or design into the flies are those large wings, so to speak, the legs. Looks like a lot of your patterns have orange, or, you know, speckled black and orange legs. And then a bulbous body, right? And it seems like, yeah, the orange legs, orange, somewhat orange underbellies are all pretty common elements of these. Is there, Dennis Dutton in White River, Arkansas, says, do you have a favorite size cicada? You just talked about that. And any particular pattern? So you mentioned easy to tie. I notice a lot of these are your patterns in here.
Right.
Is there one you favor for ease of tying?
There's a tutorial in the book there for the 17-year itch cicada. That's my pattern, and that's the pattern that I've kind of evolved and been using for the past few decades chasing these things. So, you know, works on trout, works on bass, carp, whatever. You can change that hook, like I mentioned earlier. But that's a pretty easy one, a pretty quick one, and it's ultimately a really durable one because of super glue and things like that that I employ into it. And that pattern will work just fine on the White River there, where that collar's from.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's I would imagine lots of trees on that river, and lots of nice big browns.
they're in it this year.
Oh yeah, in that big emergence, right? Is there? So we talked about some, you know, preparing for, as you called it in your book, the main event, right? And you talked about, you know, looking for them at different times, scouting, talking to locals, and we talked about the network, and we kind of touched on how long they are after emergence, but when they're flying around, is the emergence happening, you know, over, like you said, several weeks? so that you have flying insects during all those weeks, and they're kind of staggered, or do they all come out at once within a few days, and then it's, you know, then they're alive for that period of time?
Yeah, so emergences is kind of liken it to like the hockey stick effect. So if you took a hockey stick, right, and you held it straight and touched the blade tip to the ground, and imagine like that tip to the ground is like emergence is starting, and then a couple of days it's getting more and more, and then it hits the bend of the stick and it goes straight up.
Right.
That's what happens in emergence. So you're going to have those first bugs over a couple of days, and then, you know, within 8 or 10 days, all of the bugs have emerged.
Okay.
And then, so again, survival of the species usually is means, you know, we got to have a lot of mating going on. We got to have a lot of bugs laying eggs and stuff. So it's that abrupt event that confuses predators. So to have so many bugs all at once that the predation can't kill them all, so they can't proliferate, is
right.
Key there. So emergence happens really fast. And then from 8 or 10 days after that first emergence, you're going to have critical mass of bugs. And that's when they're going to start singing and flying. And that's going to go on for a couple weeks.
Okay.
And then that, what we didn't talk about is that last phase of life after mating to death is it trickles off after 4 to 6 weeks. So from the first bug emerging to the last one dying, you're talking about 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay. Okay.
With that peak somewhere in that middle. So at that
right.
2 week mark from first emergence, you're going to have a lot of flying and a lot of singing, a lot of signs. You're going to be no mistaking that there's bugs where you're present, where you're at.
Yeah. Okay, good. Bunch of questions here on fishing with cicadas. The Dan Leibarger in Illinois asked, what weight of floating line do you usually recommend for cicada emergences? I guess that depends on the fish too, right?
Yeah, it depends on the fish. It actually, cicada fishing is, and say periodical cicada, is not very technical. So if I'm on a trout river and I'm waiting, you know, I'm going to grab a 5 or 6 weight and just use a standard weight forward line. And, you know, if I'm fishing a size 6 or 4, I'm using stout tippet. And here's a little bit of disclaimer that I always mention if we're fishing for trout. Remember that time of year. It's going to be May. It's going to be June. Got to watch those water temperatures. And fish when it's safe. Below that 65 degrees is good. If it's over that, go fish for carp. Go fish for bass. Go find something else. Kind of leave those trout alone because they're going to gorge themselves. They're going to be eating a lot, high metabolizing, and if you're fighting them, you're probably going to kill a bunch of fish, and that's no good. So use stout tippet. Weight forward line is good. If I'm fishing bass or if I'm fishing from a boat, I'm going to use a 7 weight. I often grab a 7 weight to I can horse a fish in much faster. I'm not really fearing breakoffs because I'm using 0X or 10-pound tippet or 12-pound tippet when I'm fishing cicadas and kind of getting them in fast. So weight forward lines, 5 to 7 weights good. You can go up if you're after really big carp or whatever to 8 or 9 weights even, but I don't typically go under a 5 weight, even on Western rivers, just for fishing the Green River is a 5 or 6.
Yeah, okay. What are some of the effective techniques you use during cicada emergence?
Yeah, so again, not really technical. So I fish a lot of downstream, even if I'm waiting a lot of times. Remember where these bugs are going to be anywhere because they're a terrestrial insect. And once the fish key in on them, they're going to know that. So they're going to kind of be heightened senses, like with heightened senses looking for these bugs and even hunting them at times. I mentioned the carp in the lake. You'll see in reservoirs, you know, pods of carp cruising the shoreline under trees, right? So that's technique. It's kind of your fishing shorelines. And you're going to be sight fishing those fish. If I'm in a freestone river for trout and I'm waiting, I'm going to walk downstream typically from the middle of the river if I can. And I'm going to just be throwing bugs out downstream in front of me to the banks, kind of walking down, almost like I was fishing streamers. it's easier to walk downstream, and the trout are going to be everywhere, so you're kind of bombing long casts towards each shore, under trees, wherever you can find them. They're hunting them, and all these fish possess pretty good lateral lines, so they know when that big bug splats and hits the water, they often run over or race over to it from far away.
Because they know it's a big meal,
Yeah, they know.
Is there any behavior of cicadas on the water that you mimic, like skating, like you would a caddis or something like that?
No, not often. Usually it's dead drift.
Okay.
And here's a couple of exceptions. So if you just take the natural cicada and it hits the water, it's pretty much dead. It's going to get eaten by something. It's going to drown. They have no ability whatsoever to pull themselves off of the water. If they get washed into a log or there's some grass, they can certainly grab on and climb out. But they're typically done when they hit the water. So it's a dead drift most of the time. Some of them will try to, like, flutter their wings for some time, but they run out of gas pretty quick. A technique I've used on carp is throw a cast, and the fish are kind of milling around. Maybe they're moving in a direction, and then they just kind of, like, haphazardly, like, go towards the bank or towards deep water or whatever. And you've laid your cast down, and they know something hit the water. But, see, the carp can't see very well when it looks up. They're designed for down-looking into the mud. So when it lifts its head, it's blinded. It can't see. Its eyes can't see it where it's in front of its mouth is when it looks up. So they know it's there, but they don't exactly know. They know something hit the water. So I often just drag my fly. I'll lift it a foot, not off the water, but just drag it just to get some commotion. And the carp, again, lateral line, they're sensing. They're highly evolved sensory on their mouth. They triggering on it, like, oh, it must be over there, and then they find it, and you can catch that fish. So I'm not popping flies, I'm not stripping flies or actively working them. It's a whole lot of drop it, let it float, pick it up again, drop it, let it float. It's almost that commotion of the dropping the fly and the splat that really gets the attention.
Is there a time of day that's better?
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, the locomotion of the cicada depends on the ambient temperature. So hot, sunny days, middle of the day. It's not very often where you can say you've caught 27-inch brown trout at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a 93 day in a tailwater. Yeah. You know, that's a night fish, right? So, hot, the hottest parts of the day are when you want to chase them.
Particular tips you would give somebody who's, that is fly fishing an emergence for the first time?
Yeah, the best thing I can tell you is go do your scouting if you can. You know, I know some of these things would be a far drive, and certainly that's challenging. But if you're in an area where you're expecting the emergence and you have the ability to scout and go and see and go look ahead of the emergence, you will learn a ton, and you'll learn a ton about the bug, and you'll learn a ton about the fish behavior to it. I've encountered more fly anglers than I could imagine through this book that had tried to fish a cicada emergence, but they were too early, and they never went back. So go back. If you find one bug, you will find millions. So keep going back until you get those flying days and you hear the bugs, and now they're hitting the water, and I guarantee you, you're going to have great fishing.
Yeah. Any common mistakes you see anglers make?
Yeah, that's probably the most common mistake.
Too early.
The fact that people go once and they were too early and they've missed it.
Any memorable experiences that you can share with us?
Oh, how much time do you have? I'll share a few. I mean, trout listeners will like it, and then I have one for the alternative species folks. But annual cicadas on the Green River is something that, guides there and flesh ups there really push and really really share them. There's a lot of information out. And people who have experienced the cicadas on the green, they almost always return. And it's very hard to book a guide during cicada time. But if you happen to fish that, it's phenomenal. And I had just a fantastic experience there for just a couple days. I was able to go and fish the green on the A, B, C, and D sections in one of the most beautiful canyons you've ever seen.
Oh,
with
yeah.
Every fish that seemed to be 18 inches, and the only thing we fished was cicadas. And after our day in the boat with the guide, you know, we went and wade fished ourselves and caught fantastic fish, and just a great place. Standout for alternative species like carp. I really love to chase carp when it comes to periodical emergences. And, you know, a friend of mine and I, and he's actually wrote sections in the book there on lake fishing. Probably some of that lake fishing, some of those lake experiences were some of the best fishing we've ever had. And one of the experiences was, you know, a lot of experience of taking other people there, but taking young anglers and watching new anglers and young anglers catch their first 20-pound or first 10, 20-pound carp on dry flies is really memorable. It's just, it's funny. They freak out. It's just a great time for everybody. And, you know, there's so many targets when it's on, and you don't worry about missing a fish or losing one. There's always going to be a whole bunch more. So seeing kids do it, young anglers do it, it's just is a great thing.
Any final thoughts?
Yeah, get out there and chase the cicadas, especially these periodicals in 2024.
It's going to be a good year. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be a fantastic year. And, and, you know, for your listeners that purchased the book, enjoy the book. And, you know, hopefully you catch the cicada madness.
yeah, good. Well, hang tight here. We're going to, I think we've got a few people on here. We're going to try to give away your book and a couple other things here, Dave, before I let you go. So hang tight, and we'll be right back to do just that. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is a healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away a few prizes here. Our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. And if you haven't registered for tonight's show, it's too late now, but be sure you do it for the next show so you don't miss out on a chance to win some of these great prizes. So the first thing we're going to give away is a Fly Fishers International membership. And to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org and check them out. Great organization to support. Whether you win or not today, please give them your support. We're also giving away a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. So first up is the FFI membership, and looks like our winner there is Jerry Sherman. Jerry Sherman in Kentucky. So congratulations, Jerry, and I know you'll enjoy your membership to FFI. And our winner for Trout Unlimited, and if you want to learn more about Trout Unlimited, tu.org. Again, another great organization to support. And our winner for that is Peter Legreed, it looks like, in Nebraska. So congratulations, Peter. I'm sure you'll enjoy that Trout Unlimited membership as well. And now we'll give away a copy of Dave's book, and we'll see how that goes. So I'm going to ask a question, and just type in your answer into the question box on our homepage and put in your name, your location there, and the first person that answers will win. And the question's going to be, on those periodical emergences, what was the ground temperature that those emergences start to happen when they're coming out of the ground? What was that ground temperature? So we'll see if we've got somebody out there, Dave, and if so, we'll hopefully get a right answer for that. So it takes a few moments to get out there to them because there's a delay in the broadcast. So we'll give it just a second, and then I'll let you get a good night's sleep for your trip tomorrow. Got to work in the morning?
Yeah, work in the morning, yep.
Oh, yeah, and then you travel later, yeah. Well, it could be we lost the visitors that were online because we're late, so we'll just figure out how to give that book away another way after the fact. How's that?
Great. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, no problem. So, Dave, thanks so much for being on the show and hanging in there. There are technical difficulties, but everyone will be able to listen to the recording, so no problem there. And thanks so much for sharing all your incredible information on cicadas. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Roger. It was a pleasure.
Well, hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line of our menu. And in that archive, you'll find over 390 shows, which you can search by keyword, keyword phrase, like trout, tarpon, cicada, Madison River, whatever. And I'm sure you'll be pleasantly surprised at all the great shows we've done over the years. It's just an incredible library of useful information for fly fishers. So check that out. Our next broadcast will be on March 20th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, I will interview Gary Borger. And our topic for the show will be the perfect cast. And Gary is a master caster and well-known on the fly fishing show circuit for his simple explanations and fly casting demonstrations. Gary presents casting development and skill acquisition from rod grips to highly detailed descriptions of the three core methods of fly casting. He also details essential acceleration, loop formation, and energy transfer, known as ALE, plus much, much more. So listen in, and I know your casting will improve. Be sure to add this show to your calendar. Just click on the Add to Calendar button below Gary Borger's name, and you'll be all set. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Stackpole Books, Lease Ferry Anglers, Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Rico Puglisi Flies for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. I hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.
Yep.